Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Babette Smith makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Babette is an independent historian and the author of a number of books, which include A Cargo of Women, The Luck of the Irish, Australia's Birth Stain, some of which she's discussed previously at the Sydney Institute. And tonight, Babette Smith's going to speak on the topic of The Mysterious Mr. Gill, Respectable Colonial Painter, or Convict Forger. Babette Smith, you're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming along. The topic tonight is a work in progress. Frankly, I've run into such a wall of obstruction and hostility that I've decided the only solution to put what I've, is to put what I've found on the public record. On the Victorian goldfields in mid-19th century Australia, artist Samuel Thomas Gill struck gold without touching a spade. Frequently known as STG, his lively, humorous paintings of life and the diggings were widely published. Everyone wanted a copy of his work. Suddenly, the artist was a roaring success. Gill is traditionally presented as a free settler who emigrated to South Australia. Yet the truth about STG is so much more complex. It's also a case study in Australia's shame about its convict origins and an example of what we lose by covering them up. Samuel Gill was the son of the Reverend Samuel Gill, a Baptist minister. I don't disagree with anything on this slide. There's evidence to support these details. Tradition says that at age 21, Gill sailed with his parents, younger brother John, and his sister as emigrants to Adelaide. They arrived on the ship Caroline at the end of 1839. In March 1840, an advertisement announced that Samuel Gill was available as an artist. We know he'd been painting since a boy, taught by his father, who was a talented amateur. The advertisement claimed he studied with famous artists in Plymouth and at the Hubbard Gallery in London. No one doubted this story until, trawling through the convict archives looking for something else, I stumbled across the Samuel Gill. Disbelieving, I looked at the crime, which was forgery, the same passport to Australia as many other colonial artists. The Australian Dictionary of Biography repeated the standard details. Son of a Baptist minister, arrived in the ship Caroline, etc. It added, however, born in 1818. Bingo. The age of respectable Gill matched that of the convict Gill. I then read everything ever published about the artist. It became obvious that the same few facts had been recycled again and again to sketch a biography. Facts were often interpreted to fit the artwork, sometimes embellished with unsubstantiated assumptions. However, the two most rigorous authors were sceptical. Keith McRae Bowden, writing in the 70s, and Ron Appleyard, writing in the mid-80s, corresponded. Bowden told Appleyard, quote, "I've always felt there is much more to bring to the surface." My hunt in the criminal registers revealed two convict Samuel Gills. One was a solicitor's clerk tried in Birmingham in 1832. The other was convicted at Derbyshire the same year. Fortunately for me, further research revealed that the Derbyshire man died of cholera on the voyage out. That left just one, the boy whose age was the same as S.T. Gill. Research in Britain revealed that Samuel Gill, the convict, was 13 when he absconded with forged cheques from the solicitor for whom he worked. After cashing the cheques, he fled across Britain until they caught him at Liverpool. Tried at the Assize in 1832, young Samuel was sentenced to death, subsequently commuted to transportation for life. First, he was sent to the boys' hulk moored on the Thames near London. A year later, he sailed for Botany Bay. In New South Wales, Samuel was assigned to landowner Alexander Berry. For five peaceful years, he worked on Berry's farm as a clerk. Then suddenly, in 1839, the very year the artist's parents set sail, he absconded. Tracking him through the archives, I found his punishment for absconding was 12 months in an iron gang. When he ran from there, he was caught again and for the first time flogged. By 1841, he was in a gang on the Blue Mountains Road, where he absconded again. This time, he was sent to Norfolk Island. Gill spent 3 years on the island until Van Diemen's Land took over its management and he was sent to Hobart. He landed there in September 1844. The authorities ordered him to a gang at Southport, but he never turned up. Instead, his record ends with the remark, "Escaped in a fisherman's boat, supposed to have drowned at sea." There's nothing unusual in Gill's escape. Historians estimate that something like 34,000 convicts crossed Bass Strait into Victoria and South Australia, not to mention the ones that got to China and South America and India. So the two Mr. Gills, convict and free settler, meet at last. Now the challenges loom up. Forensic examination of the evidence for the first and most respectable Mr. Gill is required before their stories can be merged. Firstly, I suggest the answer to how Samuel got to South Australia lies in a newspaper report of a dinner for the artist before he went exploring with the Horrocks expedition. I detect a subtext in this article, which has traditionally been treated very seriously. The usual quote is about Gill being South Australia's respected and talented colonist, or praises him for going on the Horrocks expedition without pay. But this was a raucous gathering with music and song and much drinking. And in that context, the speeches by Gill and his friend Mr. Wiltshire seem mock solemn, as though they're sharing a private joke. Mr. Wiltshire told the company he'd had the pleasure of knowing Mr. Gill for some time, but unlike some everyday acquaintanceship, his had progressively improved. I did some research on Thomas Wiltshire. I couldn't find an emigrant by that name, but I did find a convict who was transported as a teenager like Samuel Gill. And a Thomas Wiltshire of the matching age to that convict can be found in South Australia. What's more, he was a mariner. The convict Thomas Wiltshire would have been free when Gill arrived in Hobart. It seems probable that he, either as a sailor or perhaps even master of a fishing vessel, helped Gill escape. So now Gill's in South Australia, and I must address those topics on which the tradition of the artist is traditionally pegged. There are three standout items to challenge: his arrival on the Caroline in 1839, the 1840 advertisement for work as an artist, and dates of his early South Australian artwork. When I began, I expected that one or all would bring me down. Traditionally, Gill's arrival on the ship Caroline has been regarded as indisputable. Approached with a sceptical eye, however, immigration records are illuminating. The first two stages for an emigrant required no personal appearance by STG or his father. An application was made in writing and an embarkation order was issued in return. Some writers have portrayed this process as if STG was a proactive participant. There's no evidence of that. As chief emigrant with capital to buy land, Reverend Gill was entitled to a free passage for dependents, provided they were bona fide servants and workers. His children's occupations were upgraded to fit this. Samuel becomes a fully-fledged painter and gilder. 18-year-old John is described as an accountant and a gardener. His daughter is listed as a seamstress. The third document is the passenger manifest, which was compiled by the migration agent in London from the embarkation orders. When the Gills boarded, not in London, but in Plymouth, the captain might have asked the Reverend Samuel, "Weren't you supposed to have two sons?" But if he was told he's not coming, the captain is very unlikely to have bothered or even to have altered the list. The voyage was underway. It didn't matter, except to make an extra berth available. Boarding an emigrant ship could be chaotic, particularly the earlier ships. On the 1837 voyage of the Lady McNaughton, for example, it was such a mess that the emigration agent explained the confusion was due to, quote, the greater number of passengers than listed on the manifest. The fact that, quote, some people board in lieu of others. And, quote, much confusion is caused by the lists being incorrect. For these reasons, the ship's manifest cannot be taken as 100% proof that someone travelled. Nor, for that matter, can the newspaper report at the end of the voyage. Before the port of Adelaide was built, ships moored off Glenelg. Passengers were ferried ashore in batches. Dead easy to disguise that one of the Reverend's children was not actually there. The South Australian Register sent a journalist to ask who was on board. The answer he reported was Reverend Gill and family. STG's hospital record, years later, provides a sad footnote to doubts about his arrival. When asked by the doctor how long he'd been in Australia, he didn't take the chance, as so many others would have done, to say, "I was a free settler to South Australia," or "I arrived in Adelaide in 39. Instead, he replied with the vagueness of someone used to dissembling, "about 30 years. Even that pins his arrival to 37 rather than 39. Sorry, I need a drink. All of this raises the question of Reverend Gill's role in establishing a free settler reputation for his son. Remember, 1839 was the year that Samuel the convict started to abscond. I believe his father expected STG to join them in Adelaide soon after they arrived, and it was he who placed the advertisement. He was laying the groundwork to disguise his son's convict past. Unfortunately, no business records for the newspaper survive to check who placed and paid for that ad. By itself, the ad is not enough to claim that STG was in the colony. If he was there during those first 5 years, in that small community, he would surely have been mentioned somewhere. In the press, perhaps, or in someone's diary. In fact, Ron Appleyard and I agree that the flesh and blood S.T. Gill appears for the first time in mid-1845, which is precisely the date I'd expect after his escape in late 1844. And there's another point about the artwork before I leave it. In this case, it's the evidence by absence. Where are the pictures or even the sketches done on the ship? An inveterate scribbler like Gill would not have spent 5 months without picking up a pencil or a brush. If he did sail as a free emigrant, a cache of work would depict the voyage, of passengers, sailors, life at sea, Meet to Gill. He loved that kind of thing. They would have sold readily in Adelaide. Their absence supports the claim that Gill sailed under duress in a convict vessel. Much weight has been placed on that one advertisement. Among other things, it promotes the idea that STG studied at the Hubbard Profile Gallery in London, which sounds grand, but was not. Writers about Gill have never doubted its veracity, yet it quickly falls apart under scholarly investigation. One writer even used S.T. Gill to substantiate the existence of the gallery. I can find no proof that it was in London. Gill relatives have nothing to add. Mrs. Thompson, daughter of John Gill, wrote in her memoir that Gill had studied under leading masters in London, but she had no documents to support that claim. In the end, Appleyard concluded that the 1840 advertisement is the only evidence about Gill's association with the Hubbard Gallery. My research revealed that the Hubbard Gallery was a bit like a travelling circus. Its promotion was similar in style to ads blazoning, "Come and see a woman with two heads. Watch a man swallow fire." The so-called gallery would bowl into towns all over Britain, stay for a few weeks, make as much money as possible, then move on. The description gallery refers to the exhibition of profiles and not to a building. It's possible that entranced by cutting silhouettes...
On the slide.
Thank you. There it's going, you see, they're hustling up business before it goes. It's possible that entranced by cutting silhouettes, STG, aged about 12, ran away to join the gallery when it visited nearby Bristol. Reverend Gill reacted as so many fathers would. Regarding painting as more a hobby than a life's occupation, he packed Samuel off to Birmingham to be apprenticed with the attorney. And there is evidence in the brother's memoir that the mother really wanted her boys to be lawyers. As I mentioned earlier, when I started this investigation, I expected to be disproved at every turn. It was the artwork I feared most. I expected work dated 1840 or 41 or 43. Amazingly, there appeared to be none. Instead, I found Bowden writing, quote, "Gill usually signed his work, STG, but much of it is undated and bears no title." Appleyard and his colleagues, one of whom was Ron Radford, later director of the South Australian Gallery and then the National Gallery, found that there was no contemporary record for claims that Gill visited Edward John Eyre in 1842. And Appleyard wrote about pencil drawings by Gill that did have a date 1843 on them. Quote, "The style of signature and inscriptions suggest they may have been written later in his career. The date is therefore unreliable." I was even more relieved to discover that Appleyard concluded, quote, "Gill did not begin to date his works until 1844. He then cites the painting Gawler River, November 1844, a date which coincides with Samuel's escape in late October. In a world without photography, pictures of events as they happened were valued. An event said to demonstrate STG's presence in South Australia in August 1844 is his painting of explorer Sturt's departure from Adelaide. My heart sank when I first saw it, because Samuel the convict was about to sail from Norfolk Island at that time. Further investigation revealed that STG had a habit of painting events as though he was present, when in fact he was not. Nothing dishonourable about it, but he was exposed terribly for doing this in Sydney. One newspaper sued another for misrepresentation of a horse race, which was held in Victoria, between the Victorian favourite and a Sydney horse named Vino. STG, who was living in Sydney at the time, had done the illustration as if he saw it happen. The prosecuting newspaper, Bell's Life, reported gleefully that under cross-examination, quote, Mr. Gill, the artist, admitted he had drawn both the horse and the mare from description and was not sure that he'd ever seen Vino in his life. I looked again at Gill's coverage of Sturt's departure. It contained nothing that couldn't have been any Adelaide crowd farewelling someone. The most notable feature was a bullock dray carrying an upturned boat. See it in the right-hand corner? Sure enough, the bullock dray was pulling a dray with a boat on top was reported in the newspaper, so he could have done it from that description. While we're here, just note the figure to the right of centre leaning on the paling fence, because we'll come back to him. So artwork depicting Sturt's departure does not prove STG's presence in Adelaide in August 1844. Pastoralist John Howard Angus, who was a Baptist, refers to Gill in his journal dated October 29, 1844, noting that Mr. Gill, the artist, had visited his property in the Barossa. I can't disprove that reference, but neither does it disprove my argument. It's quite feasible that STG, having just landed, needed to get out of town in case he was pursued. Family history for the years when young Gill was convicted and transported is inconsistent. Descendants of Gill's brother John described the year 1833 as deeply distressing because two younger sons died of smallpox. They told Keith Bowden it was a crushing blow from which Mrs. Gill never recovered. Bowden repeated the family version in his book, and wrote, bent on a career as an artist, when he left school, Gill went to London. But the details of this period, added Bowden, together with other family records, perished in a bushfire in 1948. Appleyard's doubts about what he was being told are evident in his footnote. Quote, it's not been possible to confirm the exact sequence of events that are said to have taken place in or about 1833. He double-checked as much as he could, confirming, for example, the birth dates of four of the five children. But evidence from the Devon Record Office, which he sought, contradicted other details given by relatives. One thing is certain. The period 1831 to 33 was a tragic one for the Gill family. The blow of the children's death would have been compounded 100-fold by STG's death sentence and his fate at transportation for life. Further support for my argument that this devastating period related to STG also, and not just to the death of the children, comes from the autobiography of his brother. John Gill skates very close to the truth when he mentions travelling with his father very often at this time, and seeing London when I was 10 years of age, which would have been 1831 to 32. John Gill doesn't mention that Samuel was on these excursions. In a surprising lapse of rigour, Ron Appleyard wrote, quote, it's assumed the elder son would have been given the same opportunity. No such assumption can be made. Samuel Gill absconded from the attorney's office in late 1831. We can justifiably speculate that his pursuers would have included not only police, but his distraught father and, it seems, his brother. He was tried in March 1832. From May 1832 to June 1833, he was on the hulk near London. Why would Reverend Gill have left his grieving wife if it was not some emergency such as these events involving their eldest son? Looking for colonial contact between father and son, I found a letter for Samuel Gill listed at the Sydney Post Office in 1836. A second letter, written early in 1841, would have read Samuel eventually on Norfolk Island. Did learning about the family's migration prompt Samuel Gill to abscond from Alexander Berry? If it did, he underestimated the danger because he brought down the full weight of the penal system around him. Nevertheless, with amazing persistence, he pursued family reunion through working in irons, floggings, and Norfolk Island. Once in Adelaide, we know that STG didn't join the family farm. Based in town, he worked as an artist. He remained unobtrusive, but newspapers now confirm that he was actually there. His brother, who had been a solicitor's clerk in England, repeated the family pattern by working for a lawyer in Adelaide. Their father reportedly became distressed about the rough company with whom STG mixed, such as Thomas Wiltshire, no doubt. In 1851, Samuel's hand was paralysed for months. Unable to paint, he soon became insolvent. Shortly after his bankruptcy was publicised, he left South Australia for the recently discovered goldfields. I come now to my latest research, where Gill's artwork intrinsically provides direct evidence that his story is not accurate. It turns out there's an inherent contradiction in Gill's earliest Australian work. He's said to be in South Australia, yet his early pictures, known collectively as the months and the seasons, depict convict farm labourers. So how did this happen? South Australia is renowned for being convict-free, today as much as in the past when it was founded. The standard biography said that Gill didn't leave that colony until 1851, when he went to the goldfields. The months and the seasons are a delicate series of watercolours which have long puzzled art historians. Local foliage and the presence of Aborigines make it clear they were painted in Australia. But when? Although signed STG, they're not dated. When sold in London in 1932 to the Australian National Library, some were bound in an album dated 1847, which implied they were painted that year. Art historians have since agreed that they are inherently juvenile work and 1847 is too late. Constrained by Gill's assumed arrival in 1839, they've dated them 1841 to 43. The location of the months and seasons is also a puzzle. The seller in 1932 believed they were painted in one place, but this has never been identified. Recently, another puzzle emerged. David Hanson, Associate Professor of Art History at ANU, focused on STG's early depiction of Aborigines. With input from Indigenous people, Hanson discovered the watercolours supposedly painted in South Australia included traces of Indigenous culture from the Shoalhaven area. These puzzles are all explicable if you accept that Samuel Gill was a convict. In that case, the months and the seasons were painted in the 1830s when Gill was a teenager and assigned to Alexander Berry's farm at the Shoalhaven. All the activities depicted in the months and the seasons occurred there, including harvesting, shearing, sheep washing, wine growing and hunting. Local Aborigines sat down on the farm when they chose. Some worked for Berry, who was sympathetic towards them. How do I know the farm workers were convicts? Recently I found documents which described convict clothing during the 1830s. The prisoners wore blue striped shirts or red or blue smocks, and remember the red smock in autumn a moment ago, or jackets, red or blue jackets. On their heads were straw hats with a black string round the crown, just like the farm labourers depicted in the months and the seasons. And that's not all. Art historians are well acquainted with Gill's habit of inserting himself into his pictures, often to make a sardonic comment. Recognizing the significance of blue-striped shirts reveals an unexpected example. Here's the painted version of Sturt departing Adelaide. You'll notice that the man who was on the side against the fence has now moved to the centre, and he's been joined by another. In an amazingly provocative and risky gesture, SCG has placed his doppelganger centre stage. Convict Gill, in his blue-striped shirt, stands talking to Gill, the artist, who's wearing a gentleman's cream suit. On his head is a straw hat with a black string around it. The picture was painted immediately after Gill arrived in South Australia, when he was most conscious of his double identity. Here's a close-up of the two figures. Now, there's nothing circumstantial about this. Based on three separate archival documents concerning the clothes, it's direct evidence supporting my argument that Gill was a convict. Perhaps Gill was always conscious he was an escaped convict. He made money from his art, but he was often ripped off by others who appropriated his work to their own name or reproduced it without permission or payment. He never publicly complained. Very likely some of those who took advantage knew that he could not. The years of Gill's success through to his decline and death are just as inscrutable as the earlier ones. He kept a low profile. Some friends found him mysterious. One from Victoria recorded, quote, "All his life he was more or less cloudy. He always seemed a solitary man, about whom nobody knew very much. He was never talked about in the newspapers. His comings and goings were unnoticed." Unquote. Historically, Gill was written off as an alcoholic whose later work deteriorated. That he dropped dead on the steps of Melbourne Post Office in 1880 seemed to confirm this version. Family denial of a convict ancestor was a common phenomenon, as I demonstrated in my book Australia's Birthday. My own family was one of thousands who hid their connection to the penal colony. STG left no descendants. Other relatives have not been willing to collaborate, which is a pity because I believe they have a contribution to make and I'd welcome their involvement. Recently, Gill's artwork has been reassessed. Now he's described by art historian Sasha Grisham as, quote, arguably the greatest mid-19th century artist working in colonial Australia, unquote. However, no new light has been shed on his life. My investigation seeks the man who produced such significant work. There he is. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. And so we come to questions and discussion, and Janet Grundy's got some copies of The Luck of the Irish, Australia's Birthday, The Startling Legacy of the Convict Era, and A Cargo of Women. So, questions, discussion. Now, you mentioned in the end the family. You started off your talk, as I recall, saying you'd met a frustration. You were frustrated and met a wall of resistance, and then you decide to come along to the Sydney Institute. So, presumably, you're expecting
where free speech reigns.
Where free speech reigns. It's true.
I know.
But why look? Why a century and a half after the event would anyone really give a toss as to whether their great, 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 probably grandparents were, or one of them was a convict or not? I mean, what do you think? I mean, is that the issue, or are there other issues, or matters, or problems, or?
Well, at the risk of being facetious, I suppose you could say only in South Australia. There may be a bit of that. They were proudly founded as a no-convict colony, and it's very much part of the Australian, of the South Australian ethos and history, very prominent. So there may be a bit of that. I made contact with someone who was descendant of the Reverend Gill's second marriage. And when I revealed that I was getting in touch because I thought I'd found convict history for S.T. Gill, he immediately responded, you're trying to ridicule him. Don't contact me again. I'll set my email so that your anything from you will go in the spam box. So I thought. I also had one other lead to a Gill relative who I contacted, but she backed off at 1,000,000 miles an hour, and I think perhaps the word had gone out that no one should deal with me. So that's a problem, and I'm sorry about it, because I think this is a fantastic story which increases our understanding of an important artist. And that's not just my opinion. Sasha Grisham says so. On the other hand, you know, I tried to talk to him about this research. Knowing he had a book coming, I thought he might like to get some advance warning, but no go. In fact, he tells me it's not important and I'm inventing a conspiracy theory. So I have reached a brick wall, and it's a pity. I'd like to talk to David Hanson about his work on the early Aboriginal paintings, because I think he found traces of Shoalhaven culture in that early picture of Aborigines. My research says Gill was at the Shoalhaven for 5 years. There's got to be a connection.
So will anyone talk to you?
Not from those quarters, no.
Well, this is going to Adelaide, so South Australia. But just
exactly.
Before we come to the next question, just come across here, stay here.
Sorry?
Just tell me again, I may have missed something. He's born in 1818, what's the year of his death?
1880, October.
So he lives to the age of, what, 62?
Yes.
All right. And he dies in what? Where?
He has a heart attack on the steps of the Melbourne post office.
And he's buried?
And he's buried as a pauper in the cemetery. But they
Melbourne General Cemetery?
Yes. I haven't seen that. Somebody, the Historical Society, put a headstone in 1904 or thereabouts. I haven't seen that, but it's not actually reflecting the grave. What I am interested in is the coroner's inquest into his death and the examination of the body. It's an official document, of course. It's referenced by Sasha as being in the State Library of Victoria, but we can't find it. I had, you know, senior heritage librarians trying to help me find it, and we couldn't turn it up. And then I went to a talk in the evening where Sasha said, I've got the inquest report upstairs. So I have not yet seen it.
But that would be a public document.
Yes, it is, but it's missing.
Oh, I see.
But it exists.
Just stay here. Just stay.
Sorry, I keep feeling I should get out of the way.
Why can't you get access?
Okay, question here, yeah.
Why can't you get access to that document?
Well, the senior archivist at the Public Record Office expected it to be there. He turned the archives over really in detail and couldn't find it. And then a senior heritage librarian at the State Library of Victoria did the same there, couldn't find it. Sasha had told me, he references the State Library with no details in his book. He told me the document was in the scrapbook, but no further details, not whose scrapbook.
Why can't he let you see it?
Well, he won't. So I don't know. Even a lead to where the original is, where he got the copy, would be helpful. I'd like to look at it for a number of reasons.
Just pursuing that line, he was obviously unhealthy for some time in Melbourne.
Gill, yes.
So in those circumstances, visiting a doctor for chest problems or things like that, if he'd been flogged, it would be on the local medical record.
Well, the suggestion is that he was obviously unwell before he died, and if he had been flogged, there would be something on a local medical record.
That's why I want to see the autopsy report. That's precisely why I want to see it. The medical record I did find about 10 years before he died does not describe his body. It gives details about his illness and talks about, you know, how long have you been here. But it doesn't describe his body, so that wasn't helpful. I thought it was going to be at first. There are probably other medical records, but they haven't been indexed yet, and it's very hard to find them, particularly as They're not in the archives. They've gone off to be digitised and, it's just, you can't get them. I'm quite happy to spend weeks going through every ward book to try and find any other visit to the hospital by Gill, but I haven't been able to do that. There may be something still to come to light. Excuse me.
Yes.
Babette, you mentioned about in your investigations and looking at it from the various paintings and the convicts' clothing, and also mentioned that you've done a lot of research into that. You didn't really mention what sources that.
So it's a question about the sources of your research into the clothing and those other matters you referred to.
Like all speakers at the Sydney Institute, I'm always very conscious. Keep it to 30 minutes. So some stuff's got to go. The sources were interesting. It's that the best research breaks are not necessarily finding a single document. Timing's important for you to alight on a document that makes sense in the light of other stuff you've found. In my case, I'd studied these paintings till I was blue in the face. And then I came across a list issued by the Superintendent of Convicts in September 1832, 12 months before Gill landed, that the clothes to be provided to convicts by their pastoral masters was to include three striped shirts. And I went, and a straw hat and a cap and other details of pants and shoes and things. So I thought, striped shirts. And then I was reviewing a book on Ludwig Leichhardt for The Australian, and I'm reading it, and I find an extract from Leichhardt's journal, who's on a pastoral estate in the Hunter Valley. And he says he's watching the workers on the farm. They're wearing blue striped shirts, and they're wearing straw hats with black strings around them. So suddenly that came together, and I knew the colour of the striped shirts that the Superintendent of Convict was talking about. And the third source was an inventory of a store on a pastoral station at Braidwood. Didn't mention striped shirts. It was, in fact, a bit earlier. It was 1829, I think. But it did mention among the stores were lots of red and blue jackets. And if there's any art historian here, they would know that the red and blue jackets also turn up in the months and the seasons.
Babette, you mentioned how Gill was ripped off by others in relation to his artworks. And you probably know that in Ballarat there's a good collection of Gill paintings.
Yes.
Are there paintings in other art museums that should be attributed to Gill, to Gill, but are instead claimed to be the work of others?
First of all, I'm not an art historian, so somebody who looks at a picture and says, that's a Gill, but it's not signed or anything, I can't identify that particularly. But I do know, because it was very puzzling to art historians, and I think a bit notorious at the time, that in the early 40s, George Fife Angus, from the Angus family, younger brother, I think he was, of the John Angus that I quoted, about Gill going there to visit. He published a book of his own paintings. He was an artist. And it's well known among art historians that Angus just appropriated some of Gill's without putting Gill's name on them. I think he probably knew that Gill was a convict. But there were other examples, but that is the most notorious. Or to me it is. Sorry.
Yes.
Did Gill ever write anything? He must have been reasonably literate, given his background. Are there any letters or anything else?
Nothing. Not a thing. Not a journal, not a letter. Nothing. Unfortunately, if they ever existed, they've been destroyed. Although there's a man here tonight who actually bought an envelope, a 19th century envelope, with a black penny stamp on it, and he thinks it's addressed to possibly Reverend Gill. So we're going to talk later.
You said he was a solitary man, no partner in it that we know about, and certainly no descendants of his own. So it's nieces and nephews who've drawn this veil.
That is correct, yes. And I think there was some dissension in the family between, or well, over the Reverend Gill's will or lack of it will. He died intestate and he was supposed to, family history says, leave the farm to John Gill, the younger brother. And because he died intestate, ultimately it ended up going to Samuel, who did take care of the widow, the second wife, but legend has it that he then drank and gambled the rest away. So, don't know. Yes, but there are no direct descendants. He did have a partner for a while, but...
Can I interrupt? Would that be a partner, would that be called a wife in those days?
She was known as Mrs. Gill, and...
I mean, partner's a sort of modern term, isn't it? Well, unless you're in the law.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's true.
So yes. He was married?
Well, he wasn't married to this woman because there's rumours that maybe he'd been married in South Australia, not that anyone's proved that yet, unless the family have information. But Elizabeth Gill, who sailed into Sydney with him in the mid-1850s, they lived in Palmer Street near Sydney, and Frederick Garling went to take painting lessons from him. And he left a description and said that Mr. and Mrs. Gill behaved like any other married couple, but he knew they weren't married. Gill returned to Melbourne in the mid to late 60s alone, so we don't quite know what happened to Elizabeth Gill. Not yet. I may find out.
Just to understand the dates of the two images of the Sturt expedition leaving Adelaide. As I understand, that's 1844.
Yes, August.
Yeah, and how does that tie to your dates from Norfolk Island?
Okay, so the question about the dates of the Sturt expedition leaving Adelaide and the dates from Norfolk Island. Okay, how do they coincide?
The date that Sturt rode out of Adelaide with great solemnity was August 1844. He got a fair way out, then left everybody there and came back in to Adelaide and had a meal and left the next day, but nevertheless. It was August 1844 and was reported in the newspapers within a day or two of that. Gill left Norfolk Island in August 1844. He landed in Hobart on the 24th of September 1844, and the convict record shows that he was ordered to go and join a gang at Southport, and he never reached there. And the record covers the period October to December, revealing he didn't turn up, and the officials reported in December that he hadn't turned up. And then you get that supposed to have drowned at sea in a fishing vessel.
But the publication date of the two images from the departure of the Sturt expedition, do they...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
1844, they still would have been en route to...
Yes.
So the public question about the publication date of the Sturt expedition paintings...
Yes, I understand.
At the time when he was in New Norfolk.
And look, I don't know that. I'd have to check it. The date of the event is August 1844. When it was first published or hung, I don't know, but I'll double check. But since Ron Appleyard, who was a curator at the Art Gallery of South Australia, says that the real Gill doesn't turn up to mid-1845, he would have known that painting well. He would have taken account of that in saying that about mid-1845. So I think when I do check, I'll find it was sometime in 1845.
So would that have been a sort of standard popular subject like the Melbourne Cup that people wanted a picture of?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was a big event.
You've been talking about Gill. The timing of this particular painting, this is a bit of trivia. In an exhibition at the time, the Margaret Grant at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, there's a little Turner painting of a lighthouse. The lighthouse is surrounded by
houses.
And if you read the citation beside it, it mentions that Turner didn't actually see this fighter. He actually painted it from a description.
There's an exhibition at the University at the Archive of New South Wales by Turner, where Turner concedes that he didn't see the lighthouse that he painted.
Yes. Look, it was not uncommon before photography. People who depicted events as though they'd happened before their eyes was very useful to the newspaper, very attractive to potential buyers.
So where do we see Gill stuff today, mainly? With Ballarat, as Peter mentioned, where else do we see it?
There are terrific collections in Ballarat and Bendigo and Geelong. There was a big exhibition at the State Library of Victoria in the middle of last year, which I went down for, had a look at, and went to a day-long conference on Gill. And I believe that same exhibition is going to be at the National Library in July this year. I don't know the precise dates, but I understand it's not coming here. It's the two major libraries, the Library of Victoria and the National Library, that have most of the Gills in their collection and jointly funded this book. So if you want to get a comprehensive look at Gill's work, and I'd urge you to do so, pop down to Canberra in the middle of the year. It's a lovely exhibition.
Now we're getting close to the end. There's a question up there.
All of the concrete artists who came here, whether they were forged or not, produced their work while they were convicts. It wasn't as if they waited until they weren't convicts and started producing work. They were producing work while they were convicts. Some of them didn't decide because they were convicts, but many did. Now, we've got a period here where you're saying his purpose, convict, was here but not doing work, except for the seasons, which there's a debate about when they were done. Wouldn't we expect a whole lot of work done between the time that your convict arrived and the time that he was in Adelaide?
So the suggestion is that the convict artist did a lot of work when they were convicts, and the suggestion is that S.T. Gill, apart from one exception which is contested, the seasons, didn't do that. Okay, that's the suggestion.
He was working as a clerk for Berry. I don't think it was easy for him to be able to paint. Most of the convict artists you referred to had a patron, either an army officer or some other official, or in Francis Greenway's case, Macquarie, who enabled them to work. I have a line of research I'm going to follow up that I think may reveal who helped Gill with the paper and encouraged him to paint the months and the seasons. And that person was a pupil of John Glover. So if I can prove it, it will also explain the influences that art historians have found in Gill's work. But it's going to be a mighty piece of research, and I don't know if I can prove that. We don't know what other sketches he did that might have been lost. I suspect he might have done some on Norfolk Island, but none have come to light. I saw one and got very excited of convicts working on Norfolk Island, not signed by anyone, and thought, ooh. But I can't prove that, and I've had trouble tracking down who even might be the painter there.
Yes, second last question.
I was wondering, in the convict records, 1833-1844, would one would expect to find a detailed description of the convict?
I'm so glad you asked me that.
Okay, so it's about the convict records, 1833-1834. Okay.
There is a detailed description, very detailed. I'm going to ask a criminal barrister, who's a friend of mine, to introduce me to one of those facial people that, you know, can turn a description into a likeness. Of course, it's a monochromatic description, but it says his eyes are brown and so on. There is a portrait that's said to be a self-portrait of a teenage Gill with brown eyes. Now, whether that's really him or whether he actually painted it, Sacha Grisham's a bit doubtful, so I'm not going to claim it is. However, Gill had three photos. The one I had up was the third one. The standout description for the convict is that he had a long face. Now, some people would know there are only a certain number of templates for faces. There's the moon face, the oval face, the square jaw, and a long face. There was the other photograph, but even this one supports, I think, a description of an official that his face was long. So, anyway, I'm going to see what I can do with a professional in reconstructing faces, see if we come up with something that might assist.
Just as a final question, we know he died on the steps of the post office in the Melbourne CBD, or what's now called the CBD. Were there any reports of that? Do we know much about that? Any local coverage of someone dying in the post office?
It was reported in the press, but very briefly. The inquest was reported in the press very briefly as well. By then, Gill had lost his profile, so nobody was very interested. Tom Roberts and Arthur Streeton and the whole Heidelberg School were flourishing from that period on. So a new generation of artists was dominating interest, and Gill's death passed almost unnoticed. Keith Bowden, in his book, actually, thank God, photographed a couple of depositions from that inquest and reproduces them in his book. So that's another reason for knowing that they still exist, those documents. It reveals a little bit about who Gill's friends were in the final years of his life and how sick he was. And it was put down to alcoholism, and there is also speculation that it was syphilis. Now, there are others who deny that it was syphilis, point blank. I'm not so sure. The recurring theme of paralysis is, I understand, a symptom of syphilis. And he was paralysed in Adelaide. He's paralysed in Melbourne, in his limbs, in the late 60s. So I think syphilis is perhaps likely to be accurate. But he certainly had a heart problem as well. I think that's actually a consequence of syphilis. There may be someone here that can explain that. But yes, poor man. He was in a bad state at the very end. But as Sasha says in his book, I'm giving Sasha's book a lot of promotion. He says that, in fact, he did some very, very fine work in his last years. And there is one description of his hand shaking so much, he had to hold it like that to steady the pencil or brush. But, and indeed, if you look at the reproduction of some of his final works in Melbourne, they are very fine. And the other thing about Gill I haven't mentioned, because it's not germane to this, but he loved dogs. And it's a very heartwarming feature of him, that there are dogs in so many of his paintings, and obviously he drew a lot of his emotional sustenance from a dog. He always had one.
Many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.